Right, so it's great to be here. I'm visiting this week. It'd be great if I can talk to you people here, see what you're doing, and stuff like that while I'm here this week. Thanks very much for Lucian for inviting me and hosting me here. So I'm going to talk to you about the topology of information flow. Well, what does that mean? We'll see. So I'm going to start by describing a well-known analogy between classical encryption and quantum teleportation. This is interesting because it works at a superficial level, but also at a surprisingly deep level as well, at least to my mind. Let me know what you think. So when we do science, we often draw heuristic diagrams, back of an envelope or something, that aren't supposed to mean anything rigorously. They just help us explain our ideas. So this is a diagram, perhaps of that nature. It's not a formal thing, but it's a useful thing. So this is supposed to be a diagram of encrypted communication using one-time pad. So what do we mean? Well, we've got various components here. Whenever I have just a solid vertical line, that means some piece of private classical information. It's the world line of that piece of information, if you like. Just going to be a straight line. So we start with some plain text. You know you're doing cryptography when you start pointlessly emitting spaces between perfectly good distinct words. So that's our plain text. That's the message that we want to encrypt and transmit. So what happens? Well, two people get together and they agree a secret key, okay, just some finite string. Doesn't matter what it is, but they have to agree on it. This has to be a shared piece of information between them. So that key creation process, that has to be non-deterministic. It's no good if it's deterministic. Every time they do this, they choose the same secret key because you assume that your adversary knows the protocol that you're using. So non-determinism is essential at that point for this procedure to make very much sense. After an encryption step, there's some ciphertext. We can treat that as public information, distribute it however we like. So heuristically indicating this with all these blue arrows. We're sending this out, copying it, sending it out to everyone who wants to listen to it, putting it on the internet perhaps. And then the decryption procedure. That's something done by this third agent here, who has possession of the second copy of the secret key. It's an operation that involves this second copy of the secret key. It also involves, it's done in the context of this broadcast ciphertext. And then the output of that decryption procedure is the decrypted message. And this procedure is successful, of course, when the decrypted message matches the plain text, so that's encrypted communication. So now let's look at a picture of a quantum teleportation where we can draw just the same picture. Right? We've got an initial quantum system. We prepare a maximally entangled state here, a bipartite state. We perform a two-system measurement, bipartite measurement. We obtain a measurement result, which is classical information. We can broadcast it. And then finally, there's a correction step where a unitary operator is applied to the second entangled system. And precisely which one is applied depends on this measurement result that was broadcasted. Okay, so that's fine. So why are these things related? Well, like we've drawn the same heuristic picture to describe them. That's the first way in which they're related. And that's been very well understood and discussed in the literature. And what we're going to do in this talk is make the connection between these things completely rigorous, and actually introduce a mapping construction that takes any instance of this thing on the left into an instance of this thing on the right. So it not only formalizes them within the same mathematical context, it also relates them directly. Okay, so we've seen the superficial analogy. It's the same pictures that we draw to understand these things. But I said this extends to the foundations of computation. That's what I mean by that. What could be controversial about this right-hand picture? Well, of course, the measurement step. Okay, this goes to the heart of our excuse me. Luckily, Lucian brought me some water. What's going on here in this measurement step in particular? Is this an invertible physical procedure or a non-invertible physical procedure? If you're interested in, say, the many worlds interpretation or decoherence as some phenomena that can be studied, that's part of quantum theory, you can use to understand the emergence of particle systems. You might say, well, this measurement procedure is just an invertible, unitary operation in which the degrees of freedom of my system become entangled with a very, very large number of external systems, which may be carrying away information about the state of my system in some particular privileged basis. Or if you want to use Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, you say this is a completely non-invertible procedure. Quantum information goes in, classical information comes out. What are you talking about? It's certainly not invertible. Now, on the left-hand side, remarkably, we have a very similar debate that we can make about that encryption procedure. So why is that? Well, this is, if this encryption has got to be any good, you could say, well, it can't, certainly can't be an invertible operation, right? Because in comes the plain text and the secret key. If the encryption operation was invertible, then an attacker could get hold of the ciphertext that was broadcast, apply the inverse, and get out the plaintext and the secret key for that matter. Okay. So if we're doing communication of a single bit, we might typically choose this encryption operation to be the exclusive OR of two bits. Two bits in, one bit out, certainly not invertible. But hang on a minute, we have to implement this encryption procedure, let's say on a classical computational device. But a classical computational device can just be described by classical mechanics. Classical mechanics has invertible time evolution. So what's going on there? How on earth can we ever perform non-invertible computation? Well, this is something that's been thought about a lot in the foundation of computation. Lots of interesting things have been written about it. In particular, it's been made clear that if you want to perform a non-invertible computation, what you've got to do is pump some entropy, some information into your environment. Of heat. So a very interesting, and this is a contentious issue, the way in which this works, what the true limits are on deleting information, the thermodynamic nature of computation, it's very fair to say that's still an ongoing area of research and debate, perhaps not quite so acrimonious as the debate is on the right-hand side, but nonetheless it's there. And it's exactly to do with invertibility or not of this procedure. And that's very interesting, and the fact that there's that debate there and that that's similar ties in nicely to the mathematical model that we're going to present. Okay, so technically what am I going to do in this talk, in this hour? I'm going to make this analogy precise. I'm going to do it using quantum field theory, actually topological quantum field theory and defects between them. That's a beautiful subject, topological field theories, which in the process of giving this talk I'll introduce you to a little bit. Now, this can be seen as part of the categorical quantum mechanics program that's been intensively underway in Oxford for about the last 10 years, initiated by Samson Abramsky and Bob Cooker. That's where I'm based in Oxford. Okay, so to start off with, we're going to see some examples of why on earth topology, topological structures, should have anything to do with information, information flow. So consider this equation. What's going on the left? How am I going to interpret this? Well, whenever I have a vertical line, think of that as a world line of some system that's carrying computational content. Time goes from bottom to top, so I start with some system here that enters the picture. Here, an event occurs, sigma, out of which two systems emerge. This is a state preparation. That's how I interpret this. So now we've got three systems. Now, there's a swap procedure that takes place. These systems exchange positions, that's fair enough. And then I apply a process sigma star, which can be thought of as a post-selection. What that does, so you can think of it as a measurement if you like, if you want to take a quantum mechanical interpretation, there's nothing necessarily quantum mechanical about this though. Sigma star says I'm going to investigate the states of these two systems, and I'm going to see if they're in some particular subspace, some particular one-dimensional subspace. If they are, that's fine, and the world can go on. If not, then fail. And in fact, start again. And keep going until this post-selection sigma star is successful. Okay? And in general, you could this sigma could be any state, sigma star could be any post-selection. Okay? So on the left-hand side, we've got this procedure. Start with the system, bipartite state preparation, swap, bipartite state post-selection. And this equation asserts that after doing those things for some particular sigma and sigma star, the result is the identity. Okay. So is this achievable? Yes, it certainly is achievable. How can we remember this? We'll see how in a moment. How can we remember this peculiar equation. Well, we could just use little bent pieces of wire for sigma and sigma star. And this is just the first Rademeister move. This is one of the classic moves that characterizes the topology of strings projected down on the plane. So suppose we've got these ingredients, this sigma star satisfying this equation, which we can depict now with this new notation. This is just nothing more, nothing less than having a one-dimensional topological field theory. It's as simple as that. That is all a one-dimensional topological field theory is. So I'm not going to define until right at the end rigorously what a topological field theory is, but you just have to understand the intuition, which is that it's a family of mathematical structures which obey equations that are the same as the equations obeyed by the actual topological structures.
So does the preparation just mean we're making two copies of the same thing and we're post-selecting on them both being the same?
Well, no, this means we're preparing two systems in some state sigma, which could be an entangled state if this was quantum theory or whatever. So sigma is the preparation of two systems, some bipartite state.
So when you replace that with a string, when you replace sigma with a string, you're not specifying sigma there. Sigma is just as general.
Going from here to here is nothing but a notational change. Okay. I don't want to write these sigmas anymore, and also I want a bit of help remembering this equation. And if I use this notation, I can just use the rule that topological deformations
sigmas could be different things, but here...
No, I've chosen some particular sigma, some particular sigma star, such that this equation is true, and I now change my notation to sigma star to save me some time when I'm drawing these pictures. Right. Okay, it's all that's happened. But it has the nice side effect that I recognize now more easily, it's just a one-dimensional topological field theory. What's this got to do with information flow? Well, in classical computation, which you might say is a setting where these lines represent systems with finite sets of states, and these processes, sigma and sigma star, represent non-deterministic creation of systems in some subset of their possible finite set of states, or and the post-selection could be verifying that your system is in some subset of its finite set of states. Then you can say, what are the states sigma star that satisfy this equation? Well, only classically when the state sigma is perfectly correlated. Right? So here's an example. Suppose this system is a classical bit, can take two values, 0 or 1. Then let's take sigma to be this state. So what this says is, either we prepare both bits in the state 0, or we prepare them both in the state 1, non-deterministically. That's how we read this. OK, so suppose our initial system is in state 0. Then I can prepare my first two systems according to this prescription. So now either I've got 0, 0, 0, in case our bipartite system was prepared like this, or I've got 1, 1, 0, in case our two systems were prepared by this. Either way, the third system is 0, right? Because that's just assuming what our input state is. Then we switch the second and third systems. Right, so we reflect that here by exchanging the second and third bits. And then we post-select. We say, I'm going to keep doing this until such a time as the first two systems are either in state 0 or in state 1. So what if we were in this first branch here? Well, the first two systems are in state 0, so the last system will be in state 0. Fine. Suppose we're in this second branch. First two systems are in state 1, 0. It's not in this subset, so we cancel and we restart. Okay? So indeed, this equation is satisfied when the input state is 0. Similarly, if the input state is 1, you can show it's also satisfied, although it's all the input states. So this equation is satisfied by this state sigma. And in general, you can show that the solutions are exactly the perfectly correlated states. So what about in quantum theory, where these vertical lines are finite dimensional Hilbert spaces and these vertices here are conjugate quantum states, the solutions are exactly the maximally entangled states, right? For very similar reasons, right? So the form of this maximally entangled state, Bell state, looks very similar, of course, to the form of this perfectly correlated classical state. Okay, so we've seen that somehow the topology of strings exactly matches the information theoretic notion of perfect correlation, which we can interpret differently in different mathematical settings. All right. So let's move on, consider something completely different. Suppose you wanted a rudimentary theory of classical information and its manipulation at the most basic level. That is, if you've got a piece of classical information, you want to be able to copy it. You want to be able to delete a copy that you no longer are interested in. And given two copies, you want to do the following basic post-selected procedure. post-select on the case that they're the same. And if those copies are the same, output that copy. If your inputs are different, then fail. So this is a post-selection. Post-selects on the case that the inputs are the same. So if I'm copying two procedures, my copying procedure is going to be represented like this. One thing goes in, two things go out. My deletion procedure is represented like this. One thing goes in, nothing comes out. And my comparison or merging procedure is going to be represented like this. Two things go in, one thing comes out. Okay? So I can just make up this notation of these little diagrams, and I can think to myself, what sort of equations would I expect to be obeyed by such procedures? Okay? Just at a very simplistic level. And it's easy to write some down. Associativity you would expect to be obeyed. If I have some piece of information, I copy it, and I copy the first copy, ought to be the same as copying the initial information and copying the second copy. I'd expect a sort of unit law to be obeyed. If I make a copy and delete one of the copies, should be the same as doing nothing. You would expect a commutativity equation to hold. If I make a copy and I switch the copies, it's the same as just making a copy because those copies are the same after all. And you'd also expect, if you think about it, this funny sort of Frobenius, so-called Frobenius equation to hold. So I should really have a little pop-up that shows why that is. So if we send in A, B here, then we'll have A, B here. And the output will then just be A, with the post-selection that A, B are the same. So what about on the right-hand side? Put in A, B. We get A, B, B. And we get out A, B, with the post-selection that A, B are the same. So that's the same on both sides. Right? So we come up with these in an ad hoc way and write these things down. And then we say, well, very nice. Are these all the equations? Well, there are certainly more equations that are true. And anyway, how can I remember these equations? How can, for any equation, how can I know if it's true or not? It turns out that the equations that are true, more or less exactly, the equations that are true for classical surfaces. That is, two little graphs drawn in this scheme ought to be equal under my interpretation in terms of copying, deleting, and merging classical information, if and only if they're associated thickened surfaces, diffeomorphic. So it should be quite obvious what I'm doing as I go from one slide to another. I'm just fattening up these little wires and then drawing them as pictures of surfaces, right? And in each case, these equations are true now, seen as statements about the existence of diffeomorphisms between surfaces. This surface is diffeomorphic to this surface, this one to this one, this one to this one. These three are all diffeomorphic. So again, we see a similar, interesting relationship. Well, not similar, but of a similar kind. If we want to describe this very basic manipulation of classical information, we can use this notation based on the topology of surfaces. And even better, the equations that will be true between composites of my information manipulation operations are exactly the equations that will be true about manipulations of surfaces. So we can change notation and use this surface calculus if we want to, instead of this sort of graph calculus. And what's great about that is it makes it completely obvious that actually, we've just got exactly a two-dimensional topological field theory, nothing else. What is a two-dimensional topological field? That sounds like a very complicated, scary thing. No, this definition is just you have a bunch of things that obey the same equations as the equations obeyed by surfaces up to diffeomorphism. What we've already seen, this is the definition exactly of a two-dimensional topological field theory. And it's well known that two-dimensional topological field theory has got connections to Frobenius algebras and so on, which you might have heard of.
Okay.
Right, sorry, right, so a diffeomorphism. Right, so diffeomorphism, well, in this dimension, actually doesn't matter, so homeomorphism is an identical relation on surfaces at this level. When you get to higher dimensions, you've got to start getting a bit worried about that. But you don't need to worry too much about smoothness here. Continuous deformation is enough. Okay, so now we're going to take this and run with this, and we're going to think about interactions between our lines and our surfaces. Why would we do this? Well, this is something that people in topological field theory do all the time. they consider so-called phase transitions or defects between their field theories. They say, I've got some field theory. I've got some field theory in this region here, A, and I've got some other field theory here. These are two states of matter. Perhaps they're topological states of matter, but you can do this for any field theory, right? And you can say, I've got a phase transition between them, X. Okay? This would be a defect between the A theory and the B theory. The defect itself is also a field theory of one dimension lower. So we could have defects on there as well. We could keep going all the way down until we get to point-like defects. So this is a huge amount of what the study of field theory, special topological field theories, is about, studying interactions. So let's study interactions here and see if we can give them an informatic interpretation. We're going to focus on three basic interaction types. As I give you this, I'm going to force spoon you in a way that any of you will be familiar with if you have a small baby. I'm going to force some interpretation onto you. Okay? So this is a mathematical model, and I'm giving you an interpretation of it. So when I give you these interpretations, it'll seem overblown, but wait to the next section when we see the theorems, and then if you can think of a better interpretation, then let me know, because I can't. Okay. So we've seen that a line seems to represent data that can be equipped with correlation, or a quantum system that can be equipped with entanglement. And we've seen that a surface can be interpreted as public information or classical information that can be copied, deleted, duplicated, compared at will. So suppose we have a defect M where one-dimensional information comes in, in a sense two-dimensional information comes out. Well, I'm going to interpret that as a measurement. If this is quantum theory, then it's a quantum measurement, actually a PVM. If we're doing some sort of classical theory, then this is a sort of broadcasting operation. I start with a physical system whose world line is a line, so that's a system localized to a point, and after this process, this system has become massively delocalized, right? Spatially, it's now a circle, and over time, it sweeps out a surface. So it's like I've broadcast that information. Okay. The upside-down version of that, I'm going to call preparation. The idea, quantum mechanically, might be I've got some classical information, and I do something, and out pops some quantum information. An example might be that, I don't know, maybe Jess can create two orthogonal quantum states, phi and psi, and which one he creates depends on what I tell him to create, right? So U would then be a classical to quantum information conversion machine, P. Now, third type, this is where the power of this topological field theory really starts coming to its own. It's a controlled operation. So here, I've only got some sort of chunk of the information. At some particular time slice, I can't see all of this surface that's existing at this time. But that's okay. That's allowed in topological field theories and field theories in general. So what's a controlled operation? How am I going to interpret an interaction like this? Well, I start off with some classical information and a quantum system. This is in my quantum paradigm. And then after my interaction, I've still got some classical information and a quantum system. The interpretation is that I do something to my quantum system on the right, and exactly what I do depends the classical information on the left. Again, why do we give it that interpretation? Well, let's see later. It's because of the representation theory of these structures, ultimately, and how they behave. I'm going to want to impose some more requirements, algebraic requirements. I want, firstly, MP and C, these three interactions, to all be invertible, in fact, unitary. Because, one could argue, all processes in physics and computer science are reversible. For a more pragmatic reason, because my theorems aren't true if they aren't unitary. We'll see the theorems in a moment. Also, these measurement and preparation procedures, I want them to come in inverse pairs. Okay, I've said these are unitary, so I want M to be the inverse of P. So if M is measurement in some basis, then P will be the preparation procedure in that base, that same basis. And I want them to be unitary, each other's inverse. In particular, that immediately implies that my measurement operation is invertible. Okay. So let's talk about that a little bit, because that's something that is sometimes seems to be the most contentious part of this formalism. So the non-contentious part first. If I do a state quantum state preparation, and then a measurement, then M and P being inverse says that the result is a cylinder. Right? A cylinder just represents propagating classical information. So I've got some classical information. Based on that classical information, I prepare a state in some orthonormal basis, and then I immediately measure again in that same basis. Of course, I recover that same classical information. Overall, this is the identity. So no one could argue with this.
So is the basis you're measuring just like considered to be wrapped up in that P circle and the M circle?
That's okay. So I assume that these M and P's come in inverse pairs. So I could write P and P star, if you like. If I had some other P, I'd need some other P star.
Okay, and they would not be inverses. If it was
certainly
P
not. If I measured
and
in some
P
basis
tilde.
Then prepared in some other basis, yeah. Definitely not. Absolutely. Okay. So let's just assume that my M and P both in relation to the same fixed orthonormal basis. What about the other way around? I suppose I perform a measurement, obtain some classical information, and I then prepare that back into the state of a quantum system in a unitary way. This tells me that the result should be the identity on the quantum system. Now, if we do this in the lab, it's not what we find. We find that this quantum system has decohered. Okay? Certainly, we don't get the identity. We can tell if we do this. But this equation does not match what we do in the lab. This does not say perform a measurement, create some classical information, allow that classical information to couple with arbitrarily many degrees of freedom outside my control, and then for some part of that classical information, re-encode it back. It doesn't say that at all. It says perform a quantum measurement, produce a large number of systems which I interpret as carrying classical information, collect all of them together, because look, this entire surface is now being fed back into this preparation procedure P. Now that's difficult to do in the lab, but it doesn't mean nonetheless that this equation wouldn't be true. So what does happen in the lab? Well, we can represent it perfectly well using our formalism. We perform a measurement, we produce classical information, the result of that is copied uncontrollably producing arbitrarily many systems. Here they are. These are all parts of a connected surface. These are photons flying out the window from which, in principle, we could recover the measurement result. And then we say, OK, I've got the classical answer 1. Now I'm going to re-encode that back into a quantum state of the system. So this is what we do in the lab when we do a measurement followed by a preparation. And this certainly does not equal the identity in any sense. That's not even well typed, because now we've got all these extra systems over here. Right? I'm certainly not asserting this is true. I'm asserting that this is true, where after performing a measurement, we collect all this that you could think of as the future light cone. I mean, this is topological, right? Because there's geometry, perhaps the future information cone of the measurement, collect all that data, and re-encode it back, you get back the identity. And I think many people on the foundations would say that sounds fair enough. Other people would say you can't do it, whatever, I don't care. This is a mathematical axiom that has some physical basis, yeah?
So P then, there you're taking P and P star and put some sort of basis.
Mm-hmm.
If you have classical information, there's usually some sort of basis in which that's encoded, right?
Yep.
So is that surface that you're drawing there, are we supposed to, is it implicit that there's like just in the cylinder, the very simple case,
yep.
Is there implicitly a basis associated with that?
That's an extremely good question. And the answer is profoundly is yes, for extremely good reasons. So why is that? Well, we've seen that every surface, there's naturally associated these structures. Okay? In particular, something looks very much, something which is associative, unital, and commutative. Okay? So we have a commutative algebra here. It turns out that this commutative algebra will be semi-simple. Show that using some particularly advanced algebra. And what are the semi-simple commutative algebras? They're exactly finite dimensional, they're exactly the finite dimensional Hilbert spaces equipped with a basis, nothing more and nothing less. Because the semi-simple finite dimensional commutative algebras, they're just direct sums of one by one matrix algebras. They're all like this. And look, this algebra has a canonical basis, right? 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0. So these surface structures carry with them automatically a privileged basis. That's absolutely essential to why all of this works. That's exactly the right question. And in this categorical quantum mechanics program, we call these classical structures, and it's central to the way that we use category theory to axiomatize these quantum informatic procedures. Lucian?
So over here, you said you had equality because this equations, these surfaces were deformable to each other.
Yeah.
Over here on the blackboard, you have equality, but they don't look.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Because now these are pure surface equations or whatever. This isn't even a manifold. Manifolds aren't allowed to change dimension at a point like this.
So what is the basis for writing an equality?
Right. So first of all, if an equation just involves surfaces or just involves lines, an equality diffeomorphism. But I'm now going to add some extra equalities to my system. I'm going to add some extra generators first. These are some extra ingredients to my calculus. Then I'm going to add some extra equations that just say M, P, and C are all unitary, and in fact M and P are each other's inverse. So that's exactly this equation, and a similar equation that says C composed with C adjoint is the identity. Okay. Right.
Can you be more concrete? You
sure.
say it's unitary. What do you mean exactly? So when you say that this
Sure. So in order to be more concrete about that, I have to tell you exactly how I'm interpreting these as Hilbert spaces and linear maps and so on, exactly what that linear algebra model is, and I haven't told you that. So I think it's a fair enough question. So why don't you wait till that comes in a few slides, then I'm happy to expand if you think that's required.
But will you have a Hilbert space associated with the incoming line
Indeed.
And another Hilbert space?
Yes, there'll be a Hilbert space associated with the incoming line, and there'll be a Hilbert space associated with this S1, which is the upper bound.
So when you call it classical, it's a special kind of classical, or
yes, well, so it's some finite set, which is a perfectly good configuration space for a toy classical system, and then we generate the free Hilbert space over that set, taking the elements of that set as an orthonormal basis.
But not will every state? Well, I'll wait. Will every state? In that Hilbert space, we have a possible state for that, or only certain ones?
Well, the basis states will be the classical states, and the other states will be superpositions of classical states.
Yeah.
Which is something we should be happy with in a sort of decoherence approach to quantum physics, anyway. If you don't want to see any states that are superpositions of classical states, then look away now.
Okay. Jamie, before you go on, can I
sure.
ask just one last question about this?
Please.
I assume that the following would not be an equation if on the, so I'm looking at the middle diagram.
Okay, yep.
If rather than just feeding the output of the
mm-hmm.
measurement, and you first, you know, created the upside down pants and then recombined them, so you had a hole in the middle.
Okay, that's a very good question. And that's something that I've elided a little bit to my...
I assume that would not be an equality.
So I omitted this, foolish of me. People always ask this question, so I should just. Right. So, fact. So, Rob is talking about this equation. We could do this, and then we could do this. Now, in terms of our information, from our information processing perspective, what's happening here, we've got some classical information, we copy it, and then we compare those copies. Well, of course, they're the same, so we should get the identity. Now, this is not true topologically. What we find is, so if this is in fact satisfied, we have a sort of degenerate two-dimensional field theory, which satisfies extra equations that it needn't satisfy, but which it does. And we will find, when we come onto our applications, I didn't actually state this here, this equation is forced on you. There are no useful models for us, which are useful for describing quantum measurement, things that we'll see where this does not hold. So actually, I should have just given this earlier. I should have given this equation earlier. It would have been simpler at this stage. So we want theory, even simpler than theory of two-dimensional manifolds. We want two-dimensional manifolds where we can ignore genus. So it's as simple as that. But you don't actually have to put it in, because actually it's forced on you later, even if you try and leave it out. But that's a good thing to ask.
And if you preceded them by measurements and followed them up by preparations, this would continue to be an identity.
Yes, as it would have to be. Yeah.
And so the idea is that regardless of what basis kind of defines this partitioning, if I sort of collect everything together, I can undo my classical process.
Exactly. Yep. So thanks very much for that very personal question. Okay. Now, what have we got now? We've got a one-dimensional theory and a two-dimensional theory equipped with some defects between them. These defects, oh my god. These defects are just the same mathematically as this general notion of phase transition. I've got some field theory here, I've got some field theory here, and I've got a defect between them. X here, maybe I've got a defect X prime here. Y is a defect from X to X prime. So, you know, when we're at school even, we see pictures of phase transitions in crystals and so on mathematically. It's very, very similar. Much simpler here, because these are topological theories. These are zero-dimensional. So P is a zero-dimensional defect between a two-dimensional theory and a one-dimensional theory. So a little bit more general than here, because here we have two-dimensional theory on both sides, and X is a line defect, and Y is a zero-dimensional defect between two one-dimensional theories. This is just a bit more general. Here we've got defects between theories of different dimensionality. So if I was talking to an audience of topological quantum field theory people, I could have skipped out all the slides so far and said, consider a 0, 1, 2 topological quantum field theory with this family of defects, and then we'd be up to speed. That's how closely what I'm doing matches established mathematics in this branch of field theory. Okay, now let's come back to this heuristic quantum teleportation diagram. Okay, this was not a formal mathematical syntax, just something that we made up that seemed to be useful. I've now got an extra thing right-hand side here. That's because if you're doing quantum teleportation, it's not just enough to do these things, right? Like these cargo cult Polynesian islanders who cut down palm trees and make little radio receivers and things. I think if they keep doing that, Prince Charles is going to land on a plane, right? You've got to do it right, okay? That is no good just to do these things. You have to choose these things such that this equation is satisfied. So on the right-hand side, this incoming system simply moved coherently across to the right-hand side. And this classical information here that's being broadcast is just uniformly random. Now I'm going to take this heuristic equation, and I'm going to reinterpret it using this topological formalism this way, okay? Using ingredients, all of which we've already seen. The entangled state preparation, that's just our notation for our little sigma that we saw earlier. The axioms of a topological field theory force that to be a maximally entangled state. This measurement procedure I'm going to replace with a zero-dimensional defect that takes a one-dimensional theory into a two-dimensional theory. We argued earlier that's a potential model for quantum measurement. This controlled operation, this correction, I'm going to model with a defect of that type. Okay? So the translation between this heuristic notation and this formal quantum field theory notation is pretty straightforward and immediate, right? I think you'll agree from one slide to the other. This was a heuristic equation, didn't really mean very much, although it was useful. This is a rigorous equation between defects of TQFTs. Okay, still, so what? Okay, I didn't give you any theorems. Okay, so just before we get to the really interesting stuff, what we've got now is a topological logic with which to reason about our system. So let's show what we can do with that. We're going to begin with this definition of quantum teleportation. I stretched it a little bit. It's just what we saw on the previous slide. So this is our definition of quantum teleportation. So let's manipulate it using our rules. First, I'm going to apply the adjoint of C on both sides. C is unitary, so the adjoint of C just cancels it out here. And on here, look, I've got the adjoint of C, right? Now I'm going to take this top right wire and I'm going to bend it down. I'm going to take this and I'm going to bend it down. I can do that. It's a topological theory. Yeah. Do the same up here. Bend it down. Here, this piece of bent wire, well, I can just deform this into a straight piece of wire. Might as well do that. Now I'm going to apply the adjoint of M on the bottom, both sides. Now I'm going to take adjoints. Take adjoints of everything. Mathematically, that means I flip everything about a horizontal axis and replace M with M dagger, C dagger with C, everything flips. Now I'm going to apply M on the top. So M is unitary, so M is cancelled out here. And I now get a new copy of M here. And then finally, for my final trick, I'll grab hold of this little lip of surface. And I will, without tearing anything, I will pull it up here. I shifted things along a little bit as well, right? So I'm doing the same here. I'm pulling this up here. Let's get this topological deformation. What are we left with? Okay, a new equation. Let's see what this says. We started with the teleportation equation, and somehow it implies this completely different equation. What's happening here? Input, some classical data. So what happens here, I've got some classical data, create a bipartite maximally entangled state, perform a controlled operation between the classical data and this quantum system. Then I perform a measurement between these two quantum systems. That's the same as just copying this piece of classical information. It's my copying vertex. So what's this a picture of? Oh, it should be really obvious. Quantum dense coding. Right, that's just what quantum dense coding is. You've got some classical information, prepare a bipartite entangled state, controlled operation measurement in this pattern. The result is just to copy the classical information. This is quantum dense coding. Yeah, Matt?
I'm slightly worried about the fact that the diagram's open on the left-hand side, because previously when you just copied classical information, you had it
closed. Okay, it's totally fine. It's fine that you're worried about it, and it's also fine. So don't worry about it. So this is just something. You're right. When I gave these equations earlier, these motivating equations, everything here was closed. Is that what you're referring to? So I didn't have any open boundaries. It's absolutely true. And if I've just got these systems, then I have what's called a one, two. Topological field theory. Why is that? Because only one and two dimensional manifolds are involved. One dimensional manifolds, because the boundaries are one dimensional. Two dimensional manifolds, because these are surfaces. That's it. But then, as a bit sneaky, later on, when I presented this, the rest of the formalism, I said I actually want to have a 0-1-2 theory. 0-1-2 theory also has points. So I've got two-dimensional surfaces, one-dimensional boundaries. Those boundaries have also got boundaries, which are points. Okay? And when we do topological field theory, often we ask for our topological field theory to be fully extended. That means everything extends down to giving invariance of zero. So you picked up on an extremely important mathematical point, which is huge technical focus. When can you extend field theories down to lower dimensional manifolds? And you picked up that I was doing that a bit sneakily. Yes, I need everything to go down to points so that I can do this. So we have dense coding. So it's a standard result by Werner that quantum teleportation and dense coding are equivalent. Here we've got the proof, and we haven't even got any Hilbert spaces yet. Okay. So, this is certainly different to Werner's proof. So in this sense, I present this formalism as a logic of quantum information. You can use it to prove things syntactically about our quantum procedures. Just as how, for example, we might have some high-level programming language like ML, we might write our classical algorithm in ML, and then because of the strong formal properties of ML, we might give a mathematical proof that our program is correct before we've even compiled it. We've got an actual program actually going to run. Okay? The ML is the abstract syntax, and it's then compiled into the actual substance of reality or whatever that's going to operate. And throughout the realm of mathematical logic, this is just what the game is, right? To develop an abstract syntax, an abstract language that helps you manipulate and talk about the formal high-level properties of things you're interested in without worrying about the low-level details. So I present that in this in that spirit, and I say this is a high-level proof of equivalence between quantum teleportation, dense coding. Okay. So, okay, let's get some actual Hilbert spaces into the game. What do these pictures have to do with computation anyway? It's just pictures, so it's just art. As much as I like art, it's just art. Well, the point is 0, 1, 2 TFTs with defects, as we're talking about, they're not abstract things. They take values in some target, say over Hilbert spaces or over whatever we want, all sorts of complicated things. But they're not studied in and of themselves. We study their representation theory. That's the whole point. People don't just care about TFTs, which I've been careful to say up to this point. People care about TQFTs. They care about representations of these topological structures in linear algebra. And the fancy modern way to say this is we can look for these structures in any symmetric monoidal two category. It doesn't matter at all what those words mean in terms of following the thrust of this talk. Now, the choice of this two category represents the theory of physics, or model of computation, in which we want to work. It's the spirit of it. For quantum computation, there's a canonical choice. There's a two-category called two Hilbert spaces. We'll see what that is. For classical computation, there's not a canonical choice, but there's something that I've described, which I call two-groupoid. This is built from groupoids. Groupoids are lists of groups. Everything's finite, by the way, so I'm not going to say finite dimensional throughout this talk. So this is groupoids, lists of groups, their actions on sets, and spans between them. Spans, just certain nice sorts of intertwiners between the actions. So if you study groups and their actions on sets, this is a very natural thing. So Hilbert spaces, this is a very natural thing. And what we find by doing this, by taking not only sort of more conventional, from a QIP perspective, quantum models of our equations, like our teleportation or dense coding equation, but also classical models, we obtain strong classical toy models of quantum phenomena, very much in the manner of Rob Speckan's famous construction from 10 years ago. I mean, I use the weaker statement here, still strong with some resemblance, because I don't think this is actually the same, but it has very similar flavor and aims and goals. And in fact, this construction, I believe, has an even stronger property. I'd be very happy to be corrected on that, and that'll come up in the last part of the talk. So what are two Hilbert spaces? They're wonderfully beautiful mathematical objects, and I want to give you a sense of them in this slide. So we begin by saying, what are complex numbers? We all know a few complex numbers, 0, 1, I, right? Root 2 minus I, dot, dot, dot. Okay? Sometimes we like to talk about the complex numbers one by one. Other times we like to group them together to their own set, which we call C. Okay. Great, that's a field, very nice algebraically closed field. It's also a complex vector space of dimension 1. Okay? And if we only want to talk about single complex numbers, that's fine. But sometimes we want to talk about pairs of complex numbers or triples of complex numbers, right? So that's fine. We can talk about those. We have two-dimensional complex vector space, three-dimensional complex vector space. Sometimes, though, we want to talk about all of these together. We want to talk about the category of Hilbert spaces. You see where this is going, okay? This is the category of Hilbert spaces. Objects are vector spaces. It's more for some linear maps. Now, that's all very well if we just want to talk about a single Hilbert space. What if we want to talk about a pair of Hilbert spaces? It's not an object in there. We're talking about a triple of Hilbert spaces. Well, this really happens in quantum information. Suppose you perform a quantum measurement. Then, depending on the answer, you might want to do completely different things. In one system, after outcome 0, you might want to go and construct another system with some Hilbert space of dimension A. After some other result, you might want to construct a system of Hilbert space of dimension B. You could do whatever you want in these different branches, so-called branches. And in general, if over the course of the procedure there could have been n different patterns of classical outcome, you could be left at the end of the day with n possible Hilbert spaces in n possible states. So what if we want to talk about pairs of Hilbert spaces or triples of Hilbert spaces? Well, then we can form bigger categories. Hilb 2 is the category where objects are pairs of Hilbert spaces. Pairs of linear maps, perfectly simple thing. Hilb 3 is the category. If you don't know about category theory, just think bag. Okay? Hilb 3 is the category whose objects are triples of Hilbert spaces and morphisms are triples of linear maps. But sometimes we don't just want to talk about each of these individually. We want an algebraic structure that incorporates them all. That is 2 Hilb. So you see how this is part of a beautiful systematic progression from the complex numbers upwards. This procedure never stops. Okay? It goes beyond my knowledge now at this limit. So what we're talking about here is this algebraic structure, 2 Hilb, and the role that it's playing for us. Something that's been extremely well studied by many mathematicians, used all over the place by high-powered representation theorists. What we're doing is very low-powered representation theory compared to the state of the art in that area. Okay, so here's a formal definition of the true category of 2 Hilbert spaces. So don't worry too much about that. There's a much, much easier way of thinking about 2 Hilbert spaces. The objects, which is an easier word, 0 cells, I should just say objects. The objects are finite dimensional 2 Hilbert spaces. So sorry, I've said this is a standard structure. It's not something crazy I'm making. We've seen that these finite dimensional 2 Hilbert spaces just given by n-fold copies of the category of Hilbert spaces in just the same way that a finite dimensional complex vector space is an n-fold copy of the complex numbers, some n. Right? Same thing's true. We don't need to care about what the particular 2 Hilbert space is, we just need to know its dimension for quantum information purposes. Same as for ordinary quantum information, we don't really care about the particular Hilbert space we have, its dimension is fine, information theory. So what are the morphisms? So in particular, we only need to remember the natural number n. Right? We need to remember how many copies of Hilb we've got. The 1 cells in 2 Hilb are defined to be these fancy things called linear functors. But it turns out we can just think of the matrices of Hilbert spaces. Okay? Hilbert spaces are given up to isomorphism by their dimension. So these are matrices of natural numbers. What are the 2 cells? They're matrices of linear maps. So we see that the ordinary quantum information formalism of Hilbert spaces, that is natural numbers, matrices of complex numbers between them, been replaced by one that's 1 level combinatorially more involved. Instead of having natural numbers and matrices of complex numbers, we've now got natural numbers, matrices of natural numbers, and matrices of matrices of complex numbers, that is matrices of linear maps. So there is a matrix calculus for 2 Hilbert spaces that's just 1 step more involved. Now, if you're thinking, oh, God, hell is all this, I can't cope with it. Quote from Schrodinger, I knew of matrix mechanics, but I felt discouraged by the methods, which are difficult to me. So really, there's nothing going on here in the grand scheme of things. Okay? And it seems impressive, I've seen all these fancy things, but that's just how poor old genius Schrodinger felt when he couldn't work out how matrix multiplication operated. So, theorem. Solutions to the teleportation equation in 2 Hilb correspond exactly to quantum teleportation schemes. By quantum teleportation schemes, I mean quantum teleportation in the usual sense which you would find in a standard quantum information textbook, pure state quantum teleportation. So again, how do we interpret that when we're now solidly over this target? We're not talking about these as just abstract pictures anymore. We're valuing them over some target. Well, now we're going to use this quantum interpretation. So we're going to interpret these lines as quantum information, these surfaces as classical information. And whenever anything happens, we're going to also interpret it the way we've seen. Initial quantum state, creation of a maximally entangled state, quantum measurement result, controlled operation, correction step, uniformly distributed classical data, undisturbed quantum information. So what do we actually choose? C is supposed to be a something valued in 2 Hilb. That means it should be a matrix of linear maps. M should be a matrix of linear maps. This point here should be a matrix of linear maps. What do we choose? Well, it turns out we can get this data almost immediately from the basic data that defines the quantum teleportation scheme. So here's a conventional quantum teleportation scheme, teleportation of a qubit using a Bell state, using the standard Bell state. Okay. This preparation here is a 1-by-1 matrix of linear maps, whose entry is a 4-by-1 matrix that defines the Bell state. I'm not putting normalization facts in. Oh, except I have them there. Okay, sorry. No, one should really put normalization facts. M is a 1-by-1 matrix of linear maps, whose entry is a 4-by-4 linear map that rotates the Bell basis into the computational basis. That's how we're using unitrees to encode our measurements. We're providing the unitree that rotates the basis that we want to measure in into the computational basis. It's just what this is. C should be a matrix of linear maps, like all these things. It's not a one, at last, it's not a 1-by-1 matrix. It's a 4-by-1 matrix of linear maps, whose entries are 2-by-2 matrices, just the correction matrices. The 4 different correction matrices, unitrees that we apply, depending on the outcome of this measurement procedure. So that's how, if we're given this quantum teleportation scheme comprising a maximally entangled state, a measurement to perform, a series of control operations, that's how we translate it to a solution of this defect equation. And this theorem says that actually the converse is true. All solutions of this equation arise in that way. Okay. And it's this theorem, and similar theorems about similar schemes, that motivate all the interpretation that I've been giving you, motivate the interpretation of this vertex as a measurement, this line of a quantum system, this surface as a classical system, classical information, this vertex as a controlled operation. Okay? It's a toy model of quantum theory with a clear mathematical setup and a nice physical interpretation, I think. Okay. Now, what about classical physics? How much more time do I have? I don't know how long these seminars are traditionally.
Only an hour. How much time do you think you need?
5 or 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, what are classical encryption schemes? Well, they're actually very easy to understand. They're given by these nice combinatorial gadgets called Latin squares. Here's a Latin square. It's an n by n grid, such that each symbol from 1 to n appears exactly once in each row and column. Okay? The way it works is you choose your plain text, that's the column, choose the secret key, that's the row, and then the ciphertext is what you get by looking at the intersection of that column and that row. And that's classical encrypted communication by a one-time pad, classified exactly by these things, Latin squares. Algebraically, these things are called quasi-groups. They're a bit like groups with inverses, but without the associativity more. So we can think of using key K encryption as multiplying under the quasi-group by K. So I haven't got time to present you this full classical model, because that would involve giving you a new 2-category and so on. This is the flavor of it. This is where we get connections with thermodynamics. Because the encryption process here has to be invertible. So it can't just be ordinary, exclusive all. So that's not invertible. So this classical information here not only has logical states that it carries with it, but also microstates, which one could call thermal states if you wanted to push the interpretation. The way this encryption procedure works, the logical state of this system here is the ciphertext, and the thermal state, or the microstate, is the key that was used. So if you can get hold of this entire output of the computation, which of course involves all the atoms that have accepted thermal vibrations from the CPU after the calculation was performed, all of that, you could run back the classical equations of motion and extract the input state to the computation, the plain text, the secret key. Well, no one surely would argue with that in principle, but of course you can never do it in practice. So in that sense, even though this encryption procedure is invertible as a mathematical object, it's still performing secure quantum computation, and it's not, and indeed, if you can only access part of the surface in the manner of in the manner of this thing here, if you can only access part of the surface, then you certainly can't reverse this encryption procedure. Only if you can access all of it. So in some sense, we see that the escape of thermal microstate information after the after a computation is mathematically analogous to decoherence. And I'm going to make a stronger statement than mathematically analogous in a moment. Okay, so I unfortunately haven't got time to talk about the details of that very much. But the point is, it's a model in which the encryption of a function, which is logically non-invertible, is actually represented mathematically by an invertible procedure. Okay, so now this is the big picture once again. We've got the theory of teleportation. We can think of this as a pure little geometrical two-category all by itself, where just those equations that mean that where the only equations that hold are the ones that I impose about my teleportation equation. No more, it's no Hilbert spaces. On the other side, I've got two Hill, the two-category lots of people have introduced, describes quantum theory. Quantum teleportation, in its traditional sense, invented by these people, is a functor T to two Hill, no more and no less. It's a theory. What's this got to do with topological field theory? Well, you can wrap topological spaces, 0, 1, 2 dimensional, into a category invented by these people, which has been setting things up like this has been a really profound shift in the study of manifolds. Atiyeh and Siegel, right, top names in mathematical physics in our century, the last century, well, and our century, I suppose, proposed a definition of topological quantum field theory. They said it's a functor from this category to this category. Right? So that's the definition of these guys. So see how closely it models our definition of quantum teleportation here. Even better, these things are extremely closely related. In fact, this thing, this theory of 0, 1, 2 dimensional manifolds, embeds into this. This is just a part without defects. To get T, we've added these funny measurement controlled operation defects. We've also got another classical side. We can define this by category. It has to do with combinatorics of finite groups. We've seen that a model of our teleportation equation in here is exactly a classical encrypted communication procedure. Now, this is the sense in which it's stronger, I believe, than other models. There's a quantization map that turns this combinatorial, finite, classical, if you like, model of computation into this quantum one. So in particular, if you've got any functor from here to here, that is any encryption procedure in this sense, given by any Latin square, you compose it with Q, you get a quantum teleportation procedure. Okay. This is already in the literature, right? Again, this damn guy Werner, okay? He's shown that it's given a scheme, it's actually slightly more general than this. So it's actually unrelated. Mine is more general in some sense, his is more general in another sense. That as Latin square is input, you get out quantum teleportation procedure. It's very closely related. So we can do this not only for teleportation, but for dense coding. These theories are isomorphic equivalent at the syntactic level before we even care about this representation theory. We can also describe mutually unbiased bases. We can recover the interaction between these things at the syntactic level. There's a known in the literature. And there's all sorts of future directions one could think about, extending to geometrical field theories like conformal theories, deal with mixed states and complete positive maps. This has been totally a pure state picture so far. We could consider other interesting phenomena. We could also think about doing this higher dimensionally. Can you teleport quantum strings, for example? So that's it. Thanks.
Question. Mm-hmm. Earlier in your talk, you introduced the notion of an inverse, for example, to your controlled operation. So you had like a C star, let's call it the inverse.
Okay.
And then you subtly assumed that it was equal to the dagger because they canceled.
No, I didn't do that.
Nope.
So
okay.
C and C dagger, they were distinct. I was never assuming C equaled its own inverse.
I thought you were assuming that C dagger was equal to its inverse, were you not? To the inverse of C? Can you go back to those bits where you were sort of going through that equation?
Short notes are difficult because it's always one side to the other and you can't see them both simultaneously. Okay, so here we start.
So when you were eliminating C,
yep.
You multiply it by its inverse operation.
Right, and C is unitary, So it's inverse, it's adjoint, C dagger. So what I'm doing is I'm post-composing on the top by C dagger on both sides. So on the left, that will just annihilate this C, because C composed with C dagger is the identity.
Yep.
On the right side, we'll just have a C dagger.
So in the quantum context, I sort of understand why the dagger would be the inverse, but in this more abstract context, you're assuming that these operations have inverses.
Mm-hmm.
How should I think about the assumption that the dagger is the inverse?
Mm-hmm.
Like what is that?
Sure, I
think
quite a concrete way. So in these classical models, we're just working with finite sets and functions between them. I don't even need the board. If you've got finite sets and an invertible function between those finite sets, then that invertible function is better just be a bijection. And the inverse bijection is just draw the graph and just reflect the graph about the axis. Right, so that's a bit like saying the reflection of the function is its inverse. So that's morally sound analogy. So also for sets and functions, the dagger for unitary functions, which is bijections, dagger of the function is its inverse. That's also just totally true.
Can I think of that as an axiom of this framework? Like there are equations that you wrote down on the board but not on the slides where you say, okay, these things have inverses, for example.
Yes. So it's
is there
an axiom.
Another axiom that says the inverse is the dagger? Should I think of it that way?
Yes,
yeah.
That's definitely an axiom. And I did write that in words on the slide, that C is unitary. And by unitary, I mean its dagger is its inverse.
Okay.
So can you go to the slide about encryption procedure?
Yep.
So you were talking about the fact that you have macro states and micro states.
Yep.
And so for this to be a good encryption procedure,
yep.
You need, in the encryption process, you need P star K to be accessible to everybody.
Yep.
And you need K to be hidden.
Yep.
So I was wondering if in this language you had any way of representing that?
Yes, a totally crucial, essential way. So in this setting, and this is some stuff that I haven't been able to go into, these surfaces are labeled by lists of groups. Seems like a very strange thing. In the case of encrypted communication of a single bit, that group Z2. And the list of groups that we assign to the surface is Z2, comma, Z2. So this Z2 has got two elements, say 1 and A, and this Z2 has also got two elements, 1 and A. And the way this formalism works means that this whole complex has got four states, the identity and non-identity associated with the first group, and the identity and the non-identity associated with the second group. Now, the way it works is that this partition is the logical partition. So these two microstates have got the same logical state, and these two microstates have got the other logical state. Okay. And the way it works is if you start with plain text of 1 and a key of 1, then your logical state will be so you can start with 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. Say this partition is logical 0, and this partition is logical 1. So this is your plain text, and this is your key. 0 plus 0 is 0, so we're here, and the key is 0. Sorry, unfortunately that's 1 here. Sorry. Okay, I'm almost done now. I can just write it without messing around. So if we start here, we will go here. If we start here, well, the exclusive OR of these is 1. So the logical state would be 1, the key is 1, and we store the key in this microstate to make it invertible. So we'll go here. Here, the XOR is 1, but the key is 0. So we'll go here. And here the exclusive OR is 0, and the key is 1. So we'll go here. So we have a bijection between the space of values of a pair of bits and the space of macrostates and microstates, a four-element set to a four-element set with a bijection. This is exactly what we use for this encryption operation here. So that distinction between the behavior of logical states and micro states is absolutely central.
Well, go back to the, can you lower that middle board again where you read the
paper? Oh, the middle board, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm still confused about the exact relation between the two manifolds or even surfaces or whatever and the physics. So,
okay.
So two things. One is the one that Rob raised, which suggests that you're sort of throwing away a large, or you're identifying a large class of surfaces with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? It has to be simply connected? Or
right, so let's
like
say...
That? So then
no.
you're in some sense losing all the loops, or you're losing...
Well, I'm allowed to talk about this surface. That's totally fine. I'm also allowed, so let's say I'm imposing this equation without these additives at the top and bottom. Then I'm allowed to talk about this surface. I'm allowed to talk about this surface. But they have to give equal linear maps, say, in R. Yeah. So I cannot tell the difference
between
a surface of genus 1 and a surface of genus 0. That's the case for that.
So you're in a very small corner of...
Actually, not such a small corner, but yes, a corner.
Is that right? Yeah, you're in a corner. Okay.
Sure. But the thing that's true is suppose I allow myself to be in the whole space and try and find solutions to these equations. But this isn't true, and there aren't any, actually. So I don't need to...
So you've kind of embedded this in the topological quantum field theory, but you haven't covered the whole space of topological quantum field theory somehow.
Well, that's true, but a slightly better thing is true, which is that when you then go out and investigate the rest of the space, you find actually there are no solutions to the rest of the space. You had to be in there.
In your particular, for your rules, there's no solution.
Yes, for this, say, for this teleportation.
Right, but
maybe for other things.
But for physics, for other...
Oh, sure.
Physics,
sure.
So it's not an identity, it's more like an embedding of one in the,
absolutely
in the
right.
other.
Absolutely
than
right.
Identification.
Absolutely. Yes.
And the second thing, just quantum to classical transition, or whatever you want to call it. I mean, you drew that picture, but that picture has a different topology, that one with the sort of tree.
So which one are we looking at? This one here?
Right, yeah, that has a different, it appears to have, well, it does have, the way you drew it, a different topology. It has more boundary components. So what do you say about that?
Well, so I drew this picture in the context that one could criticize this equation, which I do assert. One could criticize this equation by saying, well, this says if you do a measurement and then a preparation, you're left with the identity on the quantum system. That's crazy, because actually the quantum system should have been hugely affected. In fact, it should have decohered.
Yeah.
So based on that criticism, I then drew this non-equation. Right? This left-hand side is the diagram that represents what happens in a more realistic measurement preparation scenario. In a more realistic measurement preparation scenario, you don't manage after the measurement, to then collect every single physical system which has any correlation with your measurement result. It's too hard. Photons escape out of the window, which bounce off your notebook, all sorts of things. That's what this represents. And in this situation, there's no invertibility property. So this was supposed to illustrate the fact that this asserting this equation does not, in fact, deny the existence of decoherence or any such thing. Because this is what is happening in a more realistic picture. And you'll note that this is, so therefore, if this is more realistic, I'm saying this is less realistic, and you'll note that I never draw anything like this, say, in my quantum teleportation procedure. I never tell you to do this. I never tell you to do a measurement, and then collect all of the output, and then re-encode it, but I never tell you to do it. I could tell you to do it, but you would just say, well, it's too hard.
Sorry,
you don't agree
with
that.
That doesn't play any role.
Question.
Is that it?
Me?
Can I ask a follow-up question on this? After that whole discussion, I started to wonder why you distinguish lines from tubes. I mean, it seems to me that tube, as long as I have all of it and I haven't lost any of it, it is the quantum system in a way. So why couldn't I just use kind of two-dimensional spaces to represent quantum systems? And if I've lost some of it, then I say, well, that's classical because I've copied it. Can I do that?
Yep, you could do that. And every single one of these lines, you could just draw as
yep.
a very, very thin cylinder. I mean, girth
yep.
has got no meaning here,
yep.
it's just
yeah,
artistic.
Yeah.
So yes, you absolutely could do that. However, the emphasis would be wrong. Because whenever, with the current setup, whenever I draw a tube, I mean something that is equipped meaningfully with an orthonormal basis. So behaving like classical information. Whenever I draw a line, I mean something that's maybe equipped with a bipartite entangled state, but definitely not equipped with a basis. And it's simply a fact that the two-dimensional, one-dimensional distinction exactly gives me that structural distinction. Two-dimensional surfaces are exactly things that are equipped with this basis structure. One-dimensional surfaces are exactly the things that are equipped with these bipartite, maximally correlated states. So this notation is extremely suitable. If you didn't care about remembering that and you had a big enough brain to remember all that yourself, then you could. Then you could do that. But this is certainly more natural.
So in practice, do you ever use that equation in your derivation?
This equation, I know I never use it, but I've never used it in any of the derivations. However, I do use it in that it goes in implicitly into my theorems. Because when I say a theorem, things see, whenever I say a theorem like this, solution to the teleportation equation, that's one example of the teleportation scheme, I mean solution to this equation under my framework. And my framework insists that this equation holds and this equation holds. Right? It insists that topologically deformed things are equal and that these guys are unitary. So if you drop that, then this theorem simply wouldn't be true, right? Because then you could have measurements, right? And the reason is that here what we're doing is we're encoding a basis by a unitary that transforms the basis we're interested in to the computational basis. So suppose you didn't ask this to be unitary. Well, then you'd have some partial isometry here, and that doesn't... I mean, a unitary between a Hilbert space and C to the N is a very nice way of describing a basis of a Hilbert space. I get a unitary in C to the N, an ordered basis. An isometry between Hilbert space H and C to the N doesn't give you a basis, so it wouldn't be very good at describing measurement. So you get spurious solutions that have got nothing to do with quantum teleportation.
Okay, so Jamie's in office 359. And you're here all week.
Yep.
Okay. So thanks again for the
break. Okay.